Welcome to Making Sense, the podcast for people who want financial freedom without giving up their coffee, supported by our lovely friends at KiwiBank. I'm Frances Cook, an independent financial journalist and fellow financial freedom seeker who makes money simple for you. Now, money can be frustrating, and all of us have had at least once or twice when we've wondered, why isn't someone trying to make this a little bit easier for me and anyone else? Why does it have to feel like such an uphill battle? Well, there are actually some people whose job it is to work away behind the scenes, badgering the government on everything from changing our education system to retirement savings to housing. It's just that, well, there's a lot to fix and sometimes resistance to fixing it. Now, one of these people here in New Zealand is the Retirement Commissioner, and actually her job starts well before you or I turn 65. She's taking on all of those things I just mentioned, and one of her big projects at the moment is actually helping us stamp out money problems while we're still at school. Because frankly, she's got a few money regrets herself that she wants to help the rest of us avoid. So what are most of us getting wrong with our money? And are there easy wins, whether it's from us or bigger government changes? Before we get into it, Making Sense is stoked to be supported by KiwiBank. We've teamed up to bring you insight directly from their people, the experts who live and breathe this stuff every day. It's not the outdated stuff that worked 5 years ago. It's what's happening right now in the industry to help you make the most of your money. This is making Kiwi better off. This is Kiwi. Retirement Commissioner Jane Wrightson joins me now. Welcome. So, Retirement Commissioner here in New Zealand, first of all, tell me a bit about this job. What do you actually do? How do you get into this sort of role?
It's a really good question. And I think maybe it, sometimes I feel that I'm still trying to figure it out. The job itself was created after the superannuation difficulties in the 70s and 80s, where the system became very unstable. In other words, it changed between governments, and that's not helpful for long-term thinking. So as part of a package of changes, the office was created to concentrate on long-term thinking across governments, across time, and to promote various ways to think about retirement, which, of course, is something nobody thinks about until it gets perilously close. So it's got kind of three strands to it. One's a policy strand where we think quite hard around New Zealand Super. We produce quite a lot of policy papers. We can be a little bit annoying towards the government of the day by banging on about a few things that have, you know, need to be done and have been overlooked, all those kind of advocacy things that commissioners tend to do. We've got a direct-to-consumer piece where we try and talk to New Zealanders, and that's largely through the Sorted website and other activities like in schools to encourage long-term thinking and to provide independent and free and trusted information, which people can use as a baseline, which, you know, we're not selling anything, in other words, so it's a really good way to start or to reflect on whether what you're doing in your own life or what your advisor might be telling you to do. If Sorted are saying much the same thing, then you're probably on the right track. If Sorted are saying something different, then that's worth reflecting on because your personal situation might be different. But in other words, it's a baseline. And there's a little piece of work around retirement villages where we oversee the framework, the legislative framework. And I have been quite active in this space because the legislation there is 20 years old and needs a revamp. So those are the kind of three core bits. All of it's in legislation. It's an appointment made by the government of the day, and I'm in my second term.
There we go. So you can't be doing too bad if they ask you back for another hit. And I will say, I'll give a wee shout out, seeing as you mentioned Sorted, because people ask me all the time for recommendations on how do I figure out my KiwiSaver fund. And I do think the Sorted Fund Finder, you've also got Sorted Smart Investor, which is great, but the Sorted Fund Finder, if people Google that, it'll pop right up. You're sorted, literally. It is so simple. It is such an easy way for people to compare the different KiwiSaver funds. And you've also got that little quiz that takes like 10 minutes in terms of figuring out whether you should be in conservative or growth or something else. And it is so helpful having something like that that I can send people to that I'm saying, nobody is trying to sell you anything here. This is literally just
an independent assessment of what's out there and some rankings to help you figure it out. So it is very, very helpful having the sort of work that you do, which I can point people to when nobody's getting sold anything. Before you came into this role, were you someone who was always interested in money, or was this something where you got a bit of a nudge and said, hey, could you take on the retirement commission? And you kind of go, yeah, sure, maybe, I don't know.
No, I applied for the job in the usual way. I'd been in my previous gig for 13 years, which is way too long, but this is Running New Zealand On Air, which is a large public media funding body. And it was definitely time for me to move on and get some fresh blood going there. Was I particularly interested in money? I've always been a bit worried about money. But have I been obsessed and overly interested with it? Not so much. And so the learning I've done in this job is quite spectacular. All my team say this. You come into the Retirement Commission, you think you're doing, say, a marketing job or a admin job or a policy job or something, but you learn so much around money tips, money management, and how not to worry that we think it's a really good side effect of working in this space.
What sort of things used to worry you about money then, or still do maybe?
For me, what I've learned in this gig is that my risk tolerance has been, I haven't understood my risk tolerance well enough during my life. In other words, I was too conservative. So, you know, throughout my life, I've always said, oh, well, you know, I'm a balanced person, so I'll just sit and balanced and, you know, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, in your younger days, that's completely nut bar when you're thinking about long-term growth. And that's affected me now. You know, my own retirement savings are somewhat less than they could have been because I've been overly conservative. Having said that, I also lived through the 87 crash and escaped that quite neatly. So there were people even worse off than me that had a very high risk tolerance, you know. And I'm a single person, and I also had been a single parent. So worrying about having enough income and having a job has always been in the back of my mind. I think that probably stems from having parents who grew up in the Depression. My mother left school at 12 and my father at 14 because there was no money, and therefore they had little education. All of that sort of sits as a real backdrop to you from your own family background, you know. And while I've been very fortunate by comparison, like most boomers, the caution around still living knowledge of poverty is interesting, right? I don't think it leaves you. It sits in your bones.
There's some research around that if you grow up with that sort of resources being scarce when you're a kid, that it just impacts your attitude to not just money, but a whole lot of mindset things for the rest of your life. I mean, you can be actively aware of it, right? But you're still always going to be having that lens on the world, I think. What do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, my father was very ambitious. He was a builder who built quite a large building business in Hastings and then lost the lot, different story. But that driver for him was getting out of the poverty that he'd grown up in. And so I was, you know, my family, we were relatively well off by that stage, comparatively. We always knew that money had to be worked for, that it certainly didn't grow on trees. There was no inheritances in our family, you know, all that stuff. So again, it just makes you careful. What made me careful, and again, with the risk appetite that I've got, you do that money quiz and you know very easily where you're going to fit into that one.
Yeah, you start to know yourself.
Yeah. So what that means all up, I think, is that that's why, for instance, I'm neither poor nor rich, you know, because I haven't suffered the extremes. But it's good to have this knowledge. And old story, if I'd known what I know now 20 years ago, I would have done a few things differently. There you go. And I think that's why the growth of interest in personal finance is so interesting. And the work that you do and have done, incredible. My daughter, who's in her late 20s, it was the first thing she said to me when I got this gig, do you listen to Francis Cook? And I said, who?
Oh, my God, that's amazing.
Well, you hit the target market very well. The millennial target market knows you.
Oh, that's brilliant.
My daughter said, I've learned so much from her. And I went, well, I better start listening too.
And now here you are as a valued guest. So we love that. you mentioned, I've got to say, the 1987 crash, right? That looms large for a lot of New Zealanders and also, you know, just to make a big, broad, problematic generalization, but a lot of New Zealanders of your generation. I remember, you know, speaking about my work, I've been doing this now for 10-ish years. When I first started, you know, writing about shares, writing about investing, I think there was a big change in attitudes around 2020. People got much more interested in it. And I think there is more knowledge about it now. But when I first started writing about it, I could guarantee if I wrote about shares investing or taking your KiwiSaver into growth, I would get at least one, usually more, email being like, this is so irresponsible. How can you recommend it? It's a casino. Don't you know about the 1987 crash?
Aha. Interesting.
And it really loomed large for a lot of people, right? Oh. And I think it particularly, I mean, the 87 crash, that was global, but it particularly hit New Zealand. New Zealand took a long time to recover from it, more than the rest of the world. And yet now when I look at the financial world, I mean, the FMA, our money police, didn't exist then. We've got so much more regulation. We've got so many different safeguards. When I look at the money world now versus then, it's night and day for me. What about you? As someone who lived through it, does it still hold you back from investing a bit, or do you feel like it's a different environment, you're more comfortable now?
Oh, I think it's a completely different environment. And some of that is to do with the way better regulatory environment that we've got. Mm-hmm. I know regulation is very unfashionable at the moment, but good regulation is good regulation. It is entirely necessary. So you think about the crash, which was one thing, and that was global. But then you think about finance companies not much later, and that was purely regulatory, you know. Mm-hmm. So, you know, people get motivated by greed quite quickly. We get motivated and get overexcited. And don't forget both of those events, it was before the internet. So the knowledge base was quite specialized then. You know, you either had to be in the industry or use a broker or just be, you know, incredibly risky, which again, go back to risk, you know, it's a different world. I think now there's no excuse for not knowing anything. The trick is keeping finding and holding people's attention.
Yes.
And then you get into really interesting behavioural psychology, don't you? How do men take this information and do something with it? How do women view it? All this stuff. And then what motivates you to take action? You know, are you a planner? Are you a fly-by-nighter? What are you?
Yeah.
And when it comes to money, the more we can demystify it and the more we can just put it in the bucket of things we need to look at, like brushing our teeth and getting dressed every morning and all that kind of stuff, the better it is. Except that for the other two things you do every day, and you don't have to look at your money situation every day. In fact, it's a really bad idea if you do.
Yeah, exactly. Automate, and then leave it alone.
That's it.
So now that you're in the job and you've been, as you say, you're in your second term, you've been pushing for some changes and trying to help people out on this front for a while. Is there anything that surprised you since coming in and now where you are? What's been a big surprise?
How simple the basic concepts are, right? So I came in and I was a bit scared of the finance industry and I was a bit scared of the complexity. And, you know, there are aspects of the industry that are incredibly, incredibly sophisticated and hard to understand, got all that. But for the ordinary person, the concepts of money and money management and financial well-being aren't that hard. So I've been quite intent on stripping most of that back. I've been very insistent on plain English around our space. We worked very hard at the commission to publish a glossary only a couple of years ago, which we encourage all financial institutions to use, that just simplifies and standardizes wording so that those people without a financial education can actually understand things.
Tell me about it.
The basic principles are quite simple. I just summarize them as best I can as spend less than you earn where it's humanly possible. First start. And that for some people is incredibly difficult. Some because they've got particular financial issues, but others because they just don't think.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's a lot that can go wrong with money, right? There's a lot that can go right, but there's a lot that can go wrong. So Is there a big mistake that you see a lot of people make?
Mostly that's around debt, right? Mm-hmm. There's good debt and there's bad debt. And generally speaking, a mortgage, for instance, is good debt because you've got an asset at the end of it. But the rising levels of debt are always a problem. And I think buy now, pay later's got a bit to answer here. It's one thing having a credit card where your debt's summarised. It's another when you've got half a dozen buy now, pay later accounts that all fall due. What we know in our most recent research is that about a third of New Zealanders are worried about their level of debt and a bit higher if they've got mortgages. So that'll be about right. More importantly, what that leads to is no emergency savings. And if we've got one message, which is going to be our big message around Money Month, is that creating an emergency fund and holding it is probably the best thing you can do for yourself.
Yeah.
It'll stop you trying to raid your KiwiSaver. It will stop you getting into really bad debt. You know, you need enough expenses put aside. Just put, you know, salt them away slowly. You don't have to do it all at once. But so when your car breaks down, your fridge blows up, or you're off work for a couple of months, or whatever it is, you've just got that buffer, which is connected to debt, of course, because it's hard to have an emergency fund if you've also got too much debt.
Yeah.
Those would be the two mistakes we see people make, and that they're not paying attention to either of them. This is crucial.
It's interesting that you specifically mentioned the buy now, pay later as well, because I saw some interesting research. I can't remember where it was from now, but I've actually seen it more than once. So I think there's a few different places that have found this, that Gen Z tends to not like debt. They don't like things like credit cards. And yet they're often more likely to have the buy now, pay later schemes.
Yeah, it's the same thing, but worser, I think.
Right? Oh, exactly. Explain to me why it's worse, because a lot of people don't think of it as debt, I think.
It kind of, again, it depends on the kind of person you are. If you're the kind of person who pays off your credit card at the end of every month, then you're a person who knows how to manage their money and is maximizing the use of money, right? If you're the person who's always had a maxed out credit card, then you're in trouble. And if you're the person that's got more than one buy now, pay later, or you're having trouble paying them off, or you've got six of them, and you're not understanding that of the half a dozen ones you've got, you actually owe $1,000, not $100. You know, that's when you get into trouble. There's nothing wrong with them per se as an instrument. It's the way you use them.
Mm.
And if you understand why you're using them, it's a good thing. So buy now, pay later is all about, you know, current gratification. And the question is, do you need it now? Why are you using the card? If you're using it for your groceries, this is not a good sign. If you're using it for the pair of shoes that you've got on sale that are delicious and you're very hungry for them, fine, as long as you think you can pay it off before the deadline. They just can be a bit of a trap.
The literal schemes give this research to retailers saying, hey, look, you should work with us because when people split up their payments like this, they spend more than they would have otherwise. So there's some clear money psychology there that it encourages you to spend because it makes it less painful. And yet those little payments stack up. If you miss a payment, the fees are horrendous. I mean, we talk about the interest on credit cards, but the fees percentage-wise for the buy now, pay later can be enormous. You're paying so much more for the same thing.
Yeah. And it goes wider. It just goes to a broad consumer culture. You know, we're just assailed everywhere. Buy, 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 buy. And the social media platforms are getting worse. Buy, 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 buy. And you're not getting the equivalent volume of messages going, save, 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 save. You know, future joy, not current joy.
Yeah.
So it's very hard for people. You have to be a bit mindful about it. And you have to be quite cynical, I think, about the buy, buy, buy stuff.
Yeah.
It's just incessant, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. As someone who, you know, comparatively, I know that a lot of people see my social media audience as quite big, but comparatively, I'm quite small compared to a lot of accounts out there. And even then, I'm constantly getting messages from companies that would like me to be pushing stuff, promoting stuff to my audience, use this hashtag, use this discount code, but they have to buy this. It is wild to me, the massive industry that would like you to push people to buy and buy and buy. And they offer, like, I'm not trying to sledge any people with a social media audience, any influencers who do it. I'm sure that they do their research and they you know, people have their reasons, but it's big money that they offer you for putting up these messages. It is obviously a huge industry if they're willing to slap down that much cash and say, hey, you should tell people about this. So clearly it works on getting people to spend. You mentioned before about savings as well. And yes, you're right, because I've seen other, again, more than one piece of research on this, that saving more money, saving regularly, having a savings account and putting money into it regularly is one of the top things you can do to feel less stressed about money. Everyone's always like, investing seems so sexy. It's so fun. You get to earn money on your money. Don't get me wrong. Love investing. So fun. But even if you just put money into a savings account regularly, that is likely to be the number one thing you ever do for feeling less stressed with money. And it's exactly what you were saying before. Isn't it amazing how these simple changes end up having a huge impact?
Yeah. It's, you know, you'd love to be able to get into the heads of everybody who undertakes their first job, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Because your first pay packet is the biggest pay packet you've ever had. Don't you remember that?
It's so exciting. Oh, I absolutely remember. It was so good.
It's so exciting. You've never had more money before. If you're trained at that stage to put it, I'd just chuck out 10%. I put some into Kiwi Saver and some into a savings account. And if you can do 10, that's good. But pick your number and just forget about it. Because after your fourth or fifth or sixth pay packet, you're already starting to go, I haven't got enough money.
Yeah.
Because, you know, your lifestyle expands to the income you have available.
Yeah. God, I know. When I think back, like, I have had some form of job since I was 14. My very first job was picking tomatoes in a greenhouse in the middle of summer. Don't know if I recommend it. Very hot, very sticky. Tomato plants get very, very sticky on you. But
picking raspberries and strawberries for me, same gig.
There we go. Oh, this is classic Kiwi. And it's really hard work, but it all went into my terrible teenage car. And okay, the Sharesies and Invest Now of the world didn't exist at that point. But when I think about it, I still could have saved it. I still could have done something like that with it. I'm like, what a missed opportunity. But what do you do?
Life is full of ups and downs. So no matter what your everyday looks like, KiwiBank has the products and services to help you manage your money your way. To find out more, head to kiwibank.co.nz. This is making Kiwi better off. This is KiwiBank.
To take it to a different direction though, right? We've talked about what people do wrong. Is there something where a lot of people get it right and we should give ourselves more credit? Because I do feel like a lot of people are stressed about money and feel like they can never get it right. So is there something where we should actually give ourselves a bit of a pat on the back?
Yeah. I think, again, the world is changing a little bit, and a lot of it's to do with the wider availability of information that's available in many platforms, including, you know, podcasts like this. We think that people are tending to save more for bigger purchases than they were. The latest piece of research we had, which says that 76% are now saying, yep, we're saving up before we buy the big thing, compared to 70% in 2022. So that's a nice little uptick. That might be because, you know, the economy has been quite tight in the last little while. So you will now have to check to see if that uptick is permanent behaviour or just a blip. But a bit of understanding that saving up before buying is not a bad thing, not a bad thing. And we think people are getting a little bit savvier about debt, that they're trying to reduce their bad debt as best they can. And I think that's because, again, the economy has been so tough that people understand that when you're putting all your spare money into paying off interest is a very bad thing and a complete waste of money. We also know that half the population are saving for retirement. And that's remained pretty constant over the last few years, which is really cool because it's such a long way away when you start. And it isn't it will never be the top priority for quite a long time, but it's like all long-term thinking. If you just start early and then the old put some money away and forget about it trick, you'll be, you know, people are surprised about what happens. This in some ways is the beauty of KiwiSaver. Now, you know, we haven't yet got a generation that's had a full working life full of KiwiSaver, but that should make a significant difference. because without a scheme like that, you're kind of left to your own devices and it's very hard. People they do tend to be thinking about money a bit more seriously, which is just kind of good. Most people sort of do okay, you know. It's more about how you navigate life shocks sometimes, I think, and it's more about whether you can be mindful once or twice a year and just check rather than get yourself into a fizz about, you know, student debt or consumer debt or some other hole you've fallen into. The hardest thing is to pull yourself out and get going again. New Zealanders are quite resilient.
Yeah.
So we're not a wealthy people, but we're a resilient people. And we're doing a lot of things quite well now, which is good.
Excellent. Well, that's good news at least, because I think there is always, you kind of touched on this earlier and I'd like to dive into it more because there is this tension and I run into it all the time, obviously, with how much I talk about it online. I'll be talking about it online. You're talking to this massive broad audience, everyone coming from a really different background and having their own money history, their own income level, their own things that have gone on in their lives. And so you can say the same thing. It hits really differently for different people. And that's a hard thing to balance. I'm sure you run into this too. There is this tension between how much people's finances are their own responsibility and how much of it is part of a wider systemic social problem. And I do think a lot of people are feeling the pinch. It has been quite tough. I mean, last year was a nightmare for many people. Whether it's, you know, you're trying to buy a first home or whether it's literally even having enough money to pop down to the supermarket, I think people are feeling stress in different areas. So if we zoom out on the issue more broadly, do you think how much do we have an education problem where people don't understand how to handle money and get some easy wins in? And how much do you think are things getting genuinely harder and stacked against people?
Well, the answer is, of course, it's both, right? There is this absolutely some individual responsibility that needs to be taken, particularly when you have enough money to put food on the table and enough money to put into optional activity, right? So I'm not talking about the uber poor. I'm talking about those that have got sufficient funds to have some choice. And so there's a fair bit of individual responsibility at that point. Now, having said that, we all know that financial education is haphazard in the country. You learn it when by accident, by luck, like I have in this new gig, or just because you're interested. You know, the smaller number of us that, you know, become accountants by trade, that kind of stuff. But I am told that accountants aren't necessarily as good as managing their own money as they might be.
Yeah. What's the old thing about the cobbler's shoes of all is the most in need of repair? We're terrible at looking after ourselves, even if we help everyone else.
Yeah. One of my goals this year is to try and cement in a strategy for financial education in schools. We already run Sorted in Schools, which in effect trains the teachers and provides materials. And we work alongside other private sector providers, people like Banker, who've got a terrific app that's used in the classrooms, and various other organisations that are involved. We know the government's interested, and we've been working quite closely with the Ministry of Education in the last 2 or 3 years. So we've got financial education sort of half-baked into the new curriculum for maths. There's now a thing called financial maths. That's pretty cool.
Ooh, that's cool.
And so that gives us an open door to start thinking about how it might be delivered. The next trick will be getting it into something like social sciences or social studies to pick up the kids that don't do maths. And if you get across those two subjects, I understand you'll get most of them, which will be good. The next trick is to understand what the learning goals are from year 1 to year 13 and cement those in. And then the next track is to give some of these choices to schools so that they can do what they want within their own curriculum, because that's how it works, and involve the private sector in a way that makes sense. You know, if a teacher wants to do something all by themselves and has got the competency and the resources, fine, jolly good. If a teacher thinks it's not for me, then can I use somebody else's program and still get the qualification tick? Because it's quite complex going into schools, it's not as easy as just saying, let's just do it. Then I think this is a classic case of when government and our private sector can do really good work here, given that the core concepts are quite simple, as I said before. And then the trick then is to make them age appropriate and then to bake them in the later stages into things like NZCA credits, those things. So that's what we're working on at the moment. I'm not sure I'm going to get it across the line, but we'll see. But, you know, this is absolutely the ambulance. This is the ambulance at the top of the cliff stuff. If we get another generation of kids who understand basic budgeting, investing, where money comes from, what it means to them, it will be fantastic. And it's something that my generation never – my generation had a little bit of it because we had the old post office savings bank with little piggy banks. We'd come in and pop our money every week into school, and a little passbook would say we'd added another sixpence, you know. Which was amazing when you think about it, because my daughter's generation, and probably yours, had nothing like that.
Nothing.
And so everything just sort of disappeared. And so the question is how to get it back in a way that's meaningful. And so we're trying very hard.
Yeah, I can't tell you how many people say, I wish I'd learned this in school. And there is the argument, right, that how much are we wanting to listen when we're teenagers? I get it. But we should at least have the opportunity to learn this stuff earlier. And maybe if your friends know about it, then it gives you more opportunity to have it rub off on you in social settings as well. You know, you can only address what you can address. But as you say, it's complicated, right? Getting into the education system, it's not a simple system, I think we could say. So what sort of things would you like to get in there? You know, are we talking just the dollars and cents of it? Are we talking budgeting, debt? Are we going all the way up to investing? Are we including money mindset? Like, what's on the wish list of things that you would like everyone to have left school knowing?
All of those things, but age appropriate. So, you know, right at the beginning, it's very, very simple stuff. Where does money come from? What's it for? And up the other end, you know, you would be doing much more complicated stuff. And you would absolutely be looking at investing. And you'd be looking at, you know, what's good, what's bad. You'd be looking at case studies. We've got a module being taught in schools now in partnership with Inland Revenue. What is tax?
Brilliant. You
know? And we've worked with a company called Schoolkit to get it out there. And it's really good. In effect, the kids are setting up their own business, they're learning how to pay tax and doing this kind of stuff. And it's fun, you know. Inland Revenue are quite delighted and surprised that we could make it fun, but we have.
How do you make it fun? What are we talking? Are we creating computer games, or are we just like, are we trying to gamify it somehow? What are we doing?
It's much more simple than that, but they've just been creative in thinking about business concepts, that's all. And understanding that tax is important and frankly, that they're sitting in a classroom being paid for by taxpayer dollars is a great surprise to many of them.
Hey, kids, this isn't all for free. Your teacher's not here just for the love of it. I'm sure they love you too, but.
Yeah. So, you know, it doesn't have to be hard or boring. This is where the creativity of it gets quite interesting, doesn't it? Is it about money per se? Not really. It's about goals, isn't it? And about how you want to live your life. And it's about choices and all those sort of much more interesting things. Where do you see yourself in 10 years' time? Where do you see yourself in 20? You know?
Yeah.
And then how much agency have you got to realize some of those goals? And that once, this is more adult stuff now, but once people understand that, it's much more empowering, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's like the old thing. I can't stand when people say that money isn't important. I mean, money itself, sure, not necessarily important, but it impacts everything that is, right? If you're going to try and achieve something in your life or look after the people you love, money is probably going to be involved in some way, shape, or form. And if you don't understand it, it's going to be harder to hit your life goals. You mentioned KiwiSaver earlier, and KiwiSaver, I think, has been massive for filling that gap for a lot of people who did, like I did, leave school knowing nothing about money. You have KiwiSaver. It often turns up in your first job. You sign up. It ticks along in the background and you can learn some stuff just by osmosis. You can sort of pick stuff up about investing just by having your KiwiSaver ticking along. You've talked before about how you would like some changes to KiwiSaver. For any of our overseas listeners, of course, that's our retirement savings here in New Zealand.
Yeah, we've done a quite a big study on this last year, and we're going to continue doing some work this year because, you know, it's hard to get these changes pushed through. The first thing to know is that KiwiSaver, in my view, is an excellent scheme. We're very fortunate to have it. So people who might detract from it, I think, are talking through a hole in their head. So there. The main thing that needs to happen to KiwiSaver is for us to think about the default contributions. Because it's a bit sticky. You know, you put in at 3%, you don't think much else about it. And there's a kind of mindset that says, oh, well, if 3%, which is the minimum contribution, if 3% is the minimum contribution, then that's the amount I should put in. At that, and then, you know, you've got 3% on top of the employer, so that's enough. It's not quite, actually. It needs to be 4+4. We're carefully sounding out employers at the moment, going, well, what would you say if it went to 4+4? And most of the employers so far have said more positively than I would have thought, to be honest. But they kind of said, you just give us a bit of a runway and we think we can do that.
Okay. So we're talking a 4% contribution from the employee matched by 4% from your employer. That's what you'd like to see it move to.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so that defaults, if that default setting was changed, that would be spectacular. And then you can decide whether you want to put in any more or then when you want. I'm also very against the thing called total remuneration, where where the employer says, I'm going to pay you $100. And by the way, included in that is your KiwiSaver.
Yeah.
They should be saying, I'm going to pay you $100. And it should be $103, well, actually $104. And you see, employers, I know we're a lower wage country, and I know we're a smaller country and all these things, but employers get off quite lightly here, all things considered. When you think that the employer contribution in Australia is going up, is heading to 12, you know?
Yeah.
And those people who have worked in the States or in the UK will know that their employment contributions are big. And so, you know, 3 to 4% here, I don't think is outrageously awful, actually.
Yeah. Well, this is the thing, because I'm often asked to do a lot of speaking events or webinars sometimes for various employers. They'll ask me to come in and explain things to their staff. Brilliant. Love that. But sometimes if it's an Australian company, they'll say, you know, what's the difference between retirement savings? And I was like, oh, you know, we have KiwiSaver. It's like your super, but not as good. And that's my standard line, because I truly stand by it. It's very similar, but just not as good. Do you look over at the Australian system? Because as you say, much higher employer contribution. They'll put in 12%. They also get significant tax breaks to encourage that. You have more tax protections on your contributions. Do you ever look at that? Would that be a goal for you with KiwiSaver to take it that far, or is that too far for New Zealand?
I think, don't forget, they don't have NZ Super in the way that we do, right? So that's kind of the difference. And the tax breaks that are available in Australia cost a huge amount of money. We put a paper out on this last year, and it's a massive cost. So when people say we can't afford NZ Super, for instance, like, and we know we need to be more like Australia, higher private savings, we go, look at the cost of private savings. Let's just look a bit more broadly at this world. So NZ Super, which I've described as a taonga, is in effect a guaranteed minimum income, you know, for people turning 65 who have lived here for the right amount of time. We've got a two-tier system here. We've got NZ Super as a baseline. We've got KiwiSaver and private savings as the next, all voluntary. Some countries have three, a government superannuation or pension, a compulsory scheme for saving, and then some voluntary on the top. So that we've only got two keeps it simple, but it also means that I say tinker with it at your peril, you know. And if you're going to, for instance, start talking about how you might change the NZ Super settings, which I'm on record being very sceptical of, then in my view, you absolutely have to start thinking about how you supercharge private savings at the same time. And that involves hard conversations around should there be, you know, tax incentives, should there be more employer contributions. What else would we do to ameliorate the change on the kind of two-tier system so it remains in balance?
So if your big goal currently is that 4% mark, the 4% from the employer and the employee,
Because the system's not broken. So it's you know, we think it's okay. 4+4, absolutely. Get rid of total REM, go back to where it was. So employer contributions are employment contributions. And have a look at those that don't get employer matching. Which kind of self-employed people, because it won't be all of them, might benefit from an additional kind of government contribution, and how would that work? No work done on that yet, but it's worth thinking about, because all of this means that often people say KiwiSaver should be compulsory, and I thought that for quite a while. When we crunch the numbers, we're seeing that the majority of people are in KiwiSaver, and that those that aren't are either not working, children, or self-employed, or have got such a debt problem they've had to go out for a bit. And none of those are KiwiSaver contributors in any meaningful sense, right? So the sticky voluntary system is working, meaning that you're joined up whether you like it or not, and you have to withdraw rather than the other way around. That's perfect. So that the issue then becomes really a matter of contributions, employer contributions, and thinking about the self-employed. And that's all on the understanding that this, of course, is an employment-based system. So there's an equity built into it, because there always is in any system. And the inequity is for people who don't spend 40 years in the workforce. And generally speaking, at least one group of those is us, it's women. Our KiwiSaver balances are lower. Our financial situation at retirement is less. Our longevity is longer.
Yeah.
You know, very, very, very important for women to think about this with a very clear eye.
Well, it is. It's tricky, right? You know, as you say, there are certain inequities that are part of the system. I'm on record, huge fan of KiwiSaver as well. But there are some things that people mentioned to me, and I, you know, fair points, where if you're self-employed, you don't get the employer match. You can still get the government contribution, which is very worth it, just putting that out there, team, putting your $1,000 every year. But, you know, as you say, women take time out of the workforce, have babies. I'm sorry, I'm pretty sure we all want the population of New Zealand to keep being provided. So should we not look after the woman a bit? You know, in terms of, like, is there anything we can do on that front? I know sometimes people talk about, if a woman is on maternity leave, should the employer keep contributing to their KiwiSaver? Or there's talk about, you know, as you mentioned, whether there should be certain contributions, extra contributions for the self-employed. Those two groups, to my mind, are the main ones. If I've missed one, let me know. But are there solutions there? And do you think there's any appetite to bring them in is the main thing, I guess.
Yeah, there's some optionals and some legislative stuff. I mean, the government moved last year to say if you continue making your KiwiSaver contributions when you're on parental leave, the government will top you up with the employer contribution. And I went, not bad, but this is the hardest time for you on a cash flow basis, being off work with a child. I know this. So how come you have to make your own contributions? Why could the government not just put in the equivalent employee contribution just because they could? You know, it wouldn't have cost the earth. And it seemed to me to be a little bit mean-spirited. On the flip side, there's a little bit of consciousness raising we need to do as well. So partners could think about whether they could contribute to their partner's KiwiSaver if they're earning enough. They just could. And so could employers. And some employers do. Top up or continue contributions during parental leave. There's actions people can take. And the thing about this is that it just needs to be talked about, because some employers and individuals often just don't think about it, you know.
Yeah.
When we put out a paper I got a while ago that made it very clear that KiwiSaver contributions are relationship property, that caused quite a stir because people didn't understand that, you know.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, that, isn't it?
Yeah.
I don't think a lot of people expect if you get divorced, your KiwiSaver might be cracked open. You might lose 50% of it.
That's right.
Keep an eye on that one, team. What is the old thing? The way to have most wealth is same house, same spouse.
That's very, very sage. And I don't know too many people who have done it, but it's very sage advice.
I'm trying. I've got the same spouse. I did move house last year, but you have, speaking of houses, actually, this is a great segue because I've seen you make some really interesting comments about housing. And I think this is something, it is an issue all over the world where a lot of people are struggling with the price of housing, find it very difficult to buy a home, especially the first home. I think that was always a struggle, but it's really gone up by a lot in many places, definitely here in New Zealand. I've seen some stuff around where you commented about how we should have more smaller homes in New Zealand, that was part of the issue, that we didn't have a big enough range of home options, including those smaller homes. So can you lay that out for me? What's happening there? What's going wrong in that area? And how is it impacting our wealth?
For a large chunk of the older population, the bulk of their wealth is in their home. And the old way of thinking was that you will simply, cash up, trade down, pocket the difference and live off the capital that you release from a bigger, more expensive home. Now, this is not quite how it works in reality for a number of people. This, and when I'm not talking about the very wealthy here, I'm just talking about your average person. Finding your downsized home is quite hard because they're not being built, you see. So a downsized home, traditionally speaking, would be from whatever size you've come from, maybe two bedrooms, maybe one bedroom with a study, something like that, brick and tile, low maintenance, flat, one story, in a place where there are services like public transport or good roading. Nice, right? And what's being built? Multi-level townhouses, enormous McMansions with 93 bathrooms and six bedrooms, or completely hopeless.
Yeah.
And this too is a hellishly complex situation because you read things about how expensive it is to build houses in this country compared to anywhere else, all this stuff. You know, some people want to live in bigger houses, multi-generational, absolutely. We just ask people to think about, if they're thinking about all the equity being in their home, just to be careful because it's going to be harder. The other thing that's going to happen is that people will be hitting pension age still with a mortgage.
Yeah.
And there's always been a chunk that have arrived at pension age still renting. That's true. But still with a mortgage at pension age is tough because the pension is predicated on you owning your own home outright. In other words, no significant housing cost, or being in a comfortable council or social housing flat. And those things are disappearing as well, or very hard to come by, as you can see. So housing, we think, is going to be a fairly serious issue for the next generation of older Kiwis. As the focus has been on, the housing problems for young people, emergency housing, blah, 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 I just keep banging on and saying, yes, but that's not all we have to think about. Even when we're talking at these multi-level townhouses, three-level townhouses, part of me is going, why can't they be this way?
Yeah.
Why can't they be that way?
Yeah, exactly. Even as we do the housing intensification, I'll be straight up, I hadn't really thought about that, the accessibility issue. I'm sure that's huge. I'm a fan of housing intensification. I do think people need more options, especially to get into that first home. Your first home doesn't have to be your last home, and a foot on the ladder really helps, right? But when you're at that end stage of your life, the knees aren't what they were, the hips aren't what they were.
And tell me about it.
And it's just, we have to have these options for people. And I've caught flack for this before, of telling people to be careful about only having a paid off home because you need other options in your old age. But I 100% stand by it. A lot of people find, like you say, they come to that end of their working life, they're planning to downsize. Many people don't want to, for starters. It might be the house they raised their children in, they're very emotionally attached to it. But there also simply isn't, as you've pointed out, many options to actually downsize to. You see so many houses being built. It is your standard 3 or 4 bedroom home with a ring of lawn around it. Nobody wants to be touching anyone else. How do we fix this, do you think? Do we need to change building regulations? Do we need government stepping in with social housing options? What's your ideal solution?
Oh, there's no single ideal solution because this is not just about older people, obviously. The provision of social housing has to continue to be high priority. And because it's so political, you can see approaches lurching back and forth a bit. I mean, the housing problem in this country is over 30 years old now, if not longer, right? So successive governments have grappled with this, or not grappled with it, and haven't yet cracked it. So it will continue to be a high priority. And that's kind of all I've got to say about that, because it's not quite my bag of this, but it's my job to say, when we're thinking about what the impact of immigration is on our housing stock, when we're thinking about the impact of climate change on our housing stock and where it's built, when we're thinking about the need to house younger families or emergency housing or social housing, also think about the needs of older people, because they need to be included. Again, this is, we're veering off topic a bit now, but when you're thinking about what happens at end of life, very long way away, the pressure on end of life beds and end of life care will be intensifying. So it would be logical government policy just to keep people in their own home for as long as they can, right? It's easier and frankly, it's cheaper, and the people themselves want to be there. So there's lots and lots and lots of interconnecting social policy issues here, which is far too big for my brain to deal with. But I think my job is to continue to say, don't forget about the needs of older people, because they are as important as everybody else.
Yeah. At the very least, flag this looming issue of, hey guys, this needs addressing too. If there was just one thing, because it's funny, isn't it? I remember way back when I did politics, they talked about political reporting, not a politician. Just going to clarify that. Good Lord, I'd never want to be a politician. But when I did political reporting, one of the things they would always say is, if you get one major law change in your career as a politician, you've done pretty well, which is horrendously depressing and also very true. And so if there was just one thing that you got to help people do with their money, what would that be? What would be your number one thing?
As in terms of a legislative change?
In terms of anything, whether it's legislation or, you know, you finally hit this perfect educational note and people just understand it, you know, if it's just one change you could get, what would you do?
I'd just like to see KiwiSaver looked after properly. At the moment, it's got a governance problem. There isn't really a minister in charge of it. There's three ministers involved. And the ultimate minister, of course, will always be the Minister of Finance. The Minister of Finance, whoever's in that seat, will always say, there's no extra money. I'm sorry, there's no extra money. Because that's what ministers of finance do, generally speaking.
The ultimate tight ones.
So, you know, it needs to be reviewed properly every 10 years or so. It needs to be seen as a major contributor to the well-being of this country. It's hard to get anything other than incremental change through. We're starting to push the four plus four thing, and some of the, there'll be pushback within government because it will cost government money, government being a big employer, you know. So we need a bigger advocate. We need a Minister of KiwiSaver, I think, because it's important. And I don't think any government since the inception of KiwiSaver has looked at the system holistically in the way that it could. And this is important. This is important for you and me and people before us and people behind us, you know, because this is the long-term thinking bucket. And governments, of course, have difficulties with the long-term because they're on three-year election cycles. I'm not criticizing. It's just how it is. So getting long-term thinking into any kind of government system is tough. If you think about education, if you think about health, if you think about social welfare, I put retirement in that same bucket. So a way that we can get either cross-party accord on a future approach, a way that we can get a really good systemic analysis every once in a while that is less party political and more what's good for the country, something like that would be very helpful. And we don't have it. It's only me, really.
You're chugging along very well there. If for any of our listeners who have been soaking up all the wisdom, of course, and they're thinking, okay, what about for me? What's something I can take control of today? Is there something that you would love everyone to do in order to be better prepared for their retirement years?
get your emergency fund sorted because that will take a pressure off you. Make sure you stay in KiwiSaver and try and increase your contributions to 4% or more if you can. It's pretty simple, really. Mm. And think of KiwiSaver as a retirement fund. Mm. What irritates me with some of the debate that turns up is that, you know, oh, we should be able to withdraw our KiwiSaver for X, or we should be able to withdraw our KiwiSaver for Y. And I think that's because people see it as just a savings fund.
Yeah.
And it's not. It's a retirement fund. It kind of needs to be rebranded as a retirement fund, I think. I haven't got any problem with the get out of jail card free for young people and being able to use it for your first home.
Yeah.
Because a home is, as I've talked about before, one of the key things you can do to prepare yourself for a good retirement. So I don't mind that. So tight controls over withdrawals, I fully support, which is why emergency funds are important, you know. And the idea that it might be used for anything else is anathema.
Yeah. Yeah.
It is a retirement fund and hold it there. Emergency fund and KiwiSaver, and then, you know, anything else you want to save, sure. You might put yourself into your higher risk and riskier stuff there. That's all good. Get your baseline right.
I love it. You're going to have to stop me from just agreeing you to death on this one, because very much agree on that one. KiwiSaver is fantastic. But yeah, we can't just raid the piggy bank. Otherwise, you're going to lose all the benefit. You're going to really want it in the golden years because you want to kick back and do nothing and you will have earned it. So thank you so much, Jane Wrightson, Retirement Commissioner. It has been an absolute pleasure listening to what you have to say about this. And for anyone who's listening to this and thinking, ooh, I have more thoughts on this, I'd love more questions, send me more questions about this or anything else to do with money. As you can tell, I was able to feed so many of those through to Jane in this conversation. So keep sending me your questions. I'll send them through to guests as and when I can. I can't always respond to everyone individually, but I do try where I can. So you can find me Facebook, Instagram, TikTok as Frances Cook NZ. And don't forget as well, there's the Money Memo. If you want to stay off social media, so good for the mental health, sign up to my newsletter instead. That's in the description of this podcast. And it's also on my website, francescook.co.nz. And before you go, also hit subscribe on this podcast so that you never miss a trick with your money. Until next time, have a great day.
Just a note before you go, this podcast can only give you general information about how things work in most cases. It's not individual financial advice. We're all different, so some of this might not apply to your specific situation. Take what works for you, ignore the rest. If you're after individual financial advice, a financial advisor is always the best bet.